Before we get to today's show, I'd like to hear from you. This show is nothing without our listeners, and we want to make sure we provide you with what you're looking for. Our mailbox is open to all suggestions. So if you have a topic you want to learn about or a guest you want to hear from, let us know by sending us an email to jagahealthandwellness@gmail.com. That's jagahealthandwellness@gmail.com. Now, enjoy the episode. As the world gets louder and louder, the lessons of our natural world become harder and harder to hear, but they are still available to those who know where to listen. I'm Jerry Ouellette, and I was honored to serve as Ontario's Minister of Natural Resources. However, my journey into the woods didn't come from politics. Rather, it came from my time in the bush and a mushroom. In 2015, I was introduced to the birch-hungry fungus known as chaga, a tree conch, with centuries of medicinal applications used by Indigenous peoples all over the globe. After nearly a decade of harvest, use, testimonials, and research, my skepticism has faded to obsession, and I now spend my life dedicated to improving the lives of others through natural means. But that's not what the show's about. My pursuit of this strange mushroom and my passion for the outdoors has brought me to the places and around the people that are shaped by our natural world. On Outdoor Journal Radio's Under the Canopy podcast, I'm going to take you along with me to see the places, meet the people that will help you find your outdoor passion and help you live a life close to nature and under the canopy.
Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to from coming out from the mill, Pierre, to spend some time. You're out at the mill this morning, were you?
Yeah, just setting up, Jerry. It's a little early, so we're just doing maintenance on the mill right now, and the yard's a bit muddy. So we're just maybe the end of next week we'll start up, I'm thinking.
Yeah, and what are you cutting?
We're going to start. We have an order for 8x8s, jack pine, 12-foot beams, about 50 of them. So we're going to try to get that out of the way. I'm trying to get all the special orders out of the way before the mayhem starts with the 2x4s and 2x6s and cedar. So
you're getting a lot of cedar orders?
Yeah, right now we're looking at probably 1,000 boards right now to get started.
Okay. What size? 2x4 or how big?
No, 1x4, 1x6, 1x8. Then I've got to do an order of I saw on a 3/4 inch scale, and it ends up being about 5/8 the way I set my mill. So there's a lot of that for siding indoors. Guy planes it down 1/2 inch. So we got a big order of that. Different stuff, Jerry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, Pierre, I was, and I don't know if you remember, but I was reminded yesterday I was in to see my chiropractor who put a rib back in place.
Oh, wow.
Because it's the end of the sap season, so hauling those pails, 5-gallon pails out of the bush, it has a tendency to wear. And how shall I say this? The more experienced we get in life, the more that kind of stuff happens.
Right.
So we were talking about the eclipse,
oh,
you know, the big eclipse that was on down here, and
right,
everybody was in a panic mode. You had to have these special glasses and on and on and on. And so we had a discussion about it, and he was saying, he reminded me of what we did in school back in the 60s when it came across, where you took a shoebox, you punched a hole about the size of a darning needle hole in it, and you held it up to the sun, and then it shone the light through the box to the back of the box, and you looked at the eclipse that way, and everybody had all these shoe boxes basically above their head trying to get all the angle just right so they could watch the eclipse back in the 60s. And how things have changed since then, haven't they?
That's right, Jerry. I think the sunglasses, the people that make the sunglasses were in charge of telling you how to do those boxes, because everybody's got sunglasses on now, Jerry. Something screwed up there.
Oh, yes. And I found out there's a special, a significant one that you only can use, and they're only good for 3 years, so they can't be used on the next one.
Oh, no, you wouldn't want to keep it. You got to throw it away, Jerry.
No. But it's springtime, and the sap is, well, down here, the sap has stopped running. I don't even know if you tap up there or if you got guys tapping where you are.
Not much maple, Jerry.
No?
No, the only sap running around here is me.
Just roughly, you can mention if you want, but roughly whereabouts are you from a perspective of Timmins, Ontario?
I'm about 100 kilometers west, straight west of Timmins.
So okay.
A good eight to nine hour drive from Toronto. Well, you've done the drive, Jerry. You know how long it is. The kilometers, I'm not sure, but.
Yes. And it's a very special part of the province, which we very much enjoy. And now, for those that don't know, this is the guy. This is the guy that got me up. He contacted me and he said, Jerry, have you found anything yet? I said, no, I'm still looking into getting something. He says, you got to look into this stuff. Now, what's that, Pierre? It's this Chaga stuff.
Yeah, well, and you were having a little bit of trouble finding a job. I think 250 people told you you'd have a job as soon as you got out of Queen's Park. And They disappeared with the fog, and then you started looking into the Chaga. So I said, well, Jerry, look it up online. And you went online and started studying Chaga, which there's quite a bit of up here if you know where to look.
Yeah.
Since then, you've been on the Chaga harvest. So I think it's turned out not too bad for you, Jerry. I'm not sure.
Yeah, this is the guy that got me into it, that started it. And like I said then, what's that? And he said, well, if I told you, you wouldn't believe me. And he knows that I'm a little obsessive compulsive. So I'm looking it up and can't believe. So I'm collecting it and giving it away to guys like Doug, who you recall.
Right.
Doug, bless his soul, who worked with us in the ministry.
Right.
And Doug had two forms of cancer, arthritis and diabetes, and seemed to work and all that stuff. So just expanded from there.
Well, back to your impulsive compulsive, Jerry, I think you're the only guy I know that when he goes to research something on the internet, brings a lunch.
Yes, isn't that the truth? But I've had some inquiries on off-grid living.
Right.
From other people who listen to the podcast, and we're trying to answer those questions. And I thought I'd bring an expert on, because this is a guy that, well, the story may have changed, but we'll stick to the way I tell it, okay?
That sounds good, Jerry.
That you spent the entire year in the bush, or was it just the trapping season? It only came out for one day.
It was trapping season, Jerry, which would have been, I think I went in the end of August and probably came out to sell furs. It would have been end of November, December, then right back in again after freeze-up. Actually, the water used to freeze back then in November, so those days are gone now. But
oh, and I recall your dad, bless his soul, Jerry Sr., saying that when you're downriver, because we were downriver at the top trap camp. Well, would it be the top one, not the one where they had the canvas top, but
the nice camp.
Yes, the nice camp
above the falls.
He says, yeah, above the falls. And when you take the falls, how many portages there?
Oh, my God. Our trap line had, the rapids you could shoot, but the falls, there was a series of four. And then you went about 12 miles, and there was two more to get to the groundhog. So it was lots of carrying stuff. That's why our knuckles drag on the ground, Jerry.
And your dad telling us now, when you go in to spend the night, leave the motor in the water.
Right.
Because if it freezes, that way the water won't freeze in the low end of the boat motor.
Yeah, the foot.
And that way you make sure you've got a motor when you come out. Now, the first time I went to this camp, we put in and we took the road and we put it up above that rapids up at the top end.
Right.
And then how long was it wide open by boat to get to where we were going?
From the where we could drive with a 15 horse with a good load on, you're a good 2.5 hours to the first camp, maybe 3 hours. That was above the falls. That was the first camp, and then you took off from there, you know.
Oh, I thought it was longer than that because it certainly seemed, wow, is this ever nice? And then it was 2 hours into it, 3 hours into it, and it's an, when the hell are we going to get there?
Well, it might have been longer, Jerry, if we had more load, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was that Honda was an 8-horse, was it?
Yeah, with that motor, it would have been close to 4 hours.
Yeah. And so it was, and that's from where you put in and going down basically a logging road to get to the rapids that put in there, right?
Yeah. Those rapids. Back then, there was no roads on around the trap line back then. So that was our only access, really.
Yep. That was a long ways off.
It was a long way off. And then it just kept on getting worse from there. And then the next camp was down the four sets of falls, the rapids. That was about 8, 10, 12 miles, but took a day to get there because of all the carrying. And then you had another.
Yep.
And then you had another like 25 miles to get to the third camp. So that's
yes.
Lots of cold days there.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly was. And I recall you had problems with the snowmobile that you had when you were there.
Yeah, well, the snowmobiles back then were not what they are now, Jerry. So you really couldn't break trail. You had to break trail for the sled. The sled wasn't breaking trail for you.
Right.
Lots of walking on the shoes. And there was snow back then, so.
Oh, yeah. Like, so what kind of snow did you have back then as compared to, say, this year?
Well, this year we had no snow. We couldn't even make a snowmobile trail. The snowmobile guys couldn't get their trail in at all. And I was in the bush maybe 3 weeks ago cutting wood for the mill, and there was probably 6 inches of snow in the bush. So,
and
should have been about 4 feet of packed snow.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what's going to happen, Jerry. I mean, it could rain every 3 days or it could totally dry up. I don't know.
Yeah, that'll be a big problem if we don't get enough of the moisture into the ground. Otherwise, we're going to end up with a lot of forest fires this year.
Well, May's bad before leaf up, you know, because then the sun hits the bottom of the forest. May's usually a pretty bad month, so we'll see what May brings.
So, but the snowmobile that you had problems with it, and you had to take the engine out and pack it back to camp to take it apart, did you not?
Yeah, I had a, I won't say what brand, but... I was very tempted to shoot it the one time. It made me so mad. But I figured the bullet's going to bounce off and kill me. So the thing was such a miserable sled. Anyway.
So you'd get into the bush, the snowmobile would conk out, and you had a pack in the snowmobile with you. You'd take the engine out of the machine, pack it back to trap camp. Now, how big is the trap camp so people listening get a sense of how big we're talking this camp is?
Well, the mini camp, which Christine thought was haunted, was probably 10 by 12, maybe. And then the big camp was about 16 by 18.
Right.
So very easy to heat, you know. But we didn't have no pink in the walls, no nothing. It was just the fire went out, you froze.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I recall you telling me, make sure you sleep underneath, inside your sleeping bag, over your head.
Yeah, the mice were sometimes a little busy in there, let's say.
Abundant. I recall one time waking up and I could, in the camp, and what is that? And I looked down at my hand, and there was still enough light from the fire, and there was a mouse sitting on my hand chewing my fingernail.
The good old days there.
Oh, but the big thing was if there was too much mice in the camp, what happened? When you're sleeping and all of a sudden the mice are running across you, what takes place?
Yeah, I don't know. Tell me, Jerry.
Well, something's chasing the mice right across your face.
Oh, yeah. Well, Martin or whatever. There was always action.
And Martin's running across your face while you're sleeping in the middle of the night just to try and deal with that.
Well, the fall was a busy time. We didn't have much time to play house, you know. You'd spend the night at the camp, the next day you were back on the water and gone to the next camp.
Yep.
You know, so if you spent 2 days at a camp, well, that's you had a lot of skinning to do or something, you know.
Yep.
So, but back to your Chaga story, we got to thank my buddy Mike, the organic farmer in Uxbridge.
Yes.
He was the one that had the market in Toronto and said, he's the one that told me to go pick Chaga in the first place. So I brought him a whole bunch. And I think that's where I got the bug, and then that's where you got the bug. So,
yep. So Mike was we haven't had Mike on a podcast, but we had him on some of the outdoor radio journal shows that we did we did with Ange. I brought him on there and we talked about organic farming. But I should bring him on to talk about some organic farming. Maybe there'd be some interest in that.
Yeah, well, he's quite the farmer, so.
Yeah, and he's got some stories. Well, one of the stories is he had a float. Does he still have his plane?
He still has his plane, which is kind of odd because he lent the plane to a guy because Mike didn't have time to fly it and on the farm. And he said, told the guy, you can have the plane. I think they signed a 5-year deal. I don't remember. And he said, as long as you bring it back in a condition, you know, like that it's in right now.
Yep.
So the plane was gone. Anyway, one day Mike sees a thing in the paper that there had been a plane crash, and it was the same plane that Mike had. So he thought the guy crashed his plane, but actually the guy had two planes, the same, and it was the other plane. Oh. So anyway, Mike got his plane back though.
Now, so we're talking the Ivanhoe River, and he had floats on it, right? So he had it on floats on the Ivanhoe.
Yeah, and there was the old channel. They him and John were staying at the, I don't know, well, let's call it a nice camp. not too far out of town here. And Mike used to put his plane in the back there. Like there was maybe he had a mile of straight stretch, you know, that he could land on with the float. So,
right. So, and you used to do something different behind the float plane. Now, how wide is the Ivanhoe so people get a perspective of how big this?
I don't know, Jerry. Would it be 100 feet wide, maybe 150 feet wide? I don't know.
Okay. So, And you used to do something with Mike and John with the plane that most people would never even consider. So a lot of times you jump in, and what did you used to do behind the plane?
Sometimes I think we water skied, Jerry. We used to come up with a lot of weird plans.
So you water skied behind the float plane on the Ivanhoe River. Yeah, I could just imagine you going near town and people seeing, and what is that all about?
Yeah.
Now, you had some other stuff, too. You had some experiences in water skiing with different methods, because when you're off-grid or when you're in the bush, you have some different ideas of what will work and what might not work. And some of the other ones you had?
Well, we did try the plywood thing, which ended up stuck in the bottom of the Ivanhoe with a pair of running shoes nailed to it. That didn't work out very well either. And at that time, I had a broken arm, and they were laughing at me because I couldn't get up on the water skis because my one arm didn't work that good. But of course they laughed at me. But anyway, I'm like, well, now I know why I couldn't hold on to the goddamn rope.
So it was so much, it was worth a story, right?
Oh yeah. Lots of stories, Jerry. Lots of stories.
Yeah. And some of the other stuff you used to do was, how did you used to check for beaver houses on the Ivanhoe as well?
Well, we would just go up and down. We'd mostly walk. Sometimes we'd have a buddy with a plane. We'd fly.
So what would you – how do you mean you'd fly? What would you do?
Well, like if Mike had his plane going, he'd do a flight for us. You know, we'd fly over the creeks and just see if we could spot the house. It'd save a lot of walking, right? Now I guess you would use a drone, but anyway.
And then true enough.
I had my first dog. You remember Clyde.
Oh, very much, yeah.
He'd hold the boat for me. I'd get off and say, Clyde out. He'd go up, hold the boat. I'd go check the trap, come back, Clyde in. We'd do that all day.
And he got to the point where he just pulled into the shore and he just jumped out with the boat, with the rope in his mouth.
Yeah.
And he'd pull it tight and sit there.
He'd sit there. I made him a collar after a while. And with a big snap on it, he'd sit there and hold that boat. He liked getting in and out because it was cold all the time, right? So he'd warm up.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happened to Clyde in the end?
Clyde, well, we had two Airedales. The one got killed by a bear in the yard here. He had a real passion on for bears. And the one day bear showed up and I'm like, oh, stupid bear. And the dog chased it in the backyard. And when it got to the river, I guess the bear didn't really want to cross.
Right.
So took us a day or two to find the dog, but it looked like there wasn't even a mark on the dog. But when you moved his front shoulder, it was like a bag of toys in there. He was just crushed. So
yeah, when you're living where you're living, you're pretty close to nature. So bears are pretty much prevalent everywhere. Now, there was another bear story I remember you telling me. You saw a bear go into the, was it the horse barn?
Yeah, well, we had the horses back then. My brother had the horses, but they stayed here in the barn. And when the bear come around, the horses didn't like it very much. They get pretty excited. So it was November, and we were done trapping. So we had come out of the bush, and I'd left the boat face up. And I could hear the bear in the feed shed. And so anyway, I got the rifle out, and I'm like, okay, we'll take care of the bear. And it was dark out, a little bit dark out. So I, not thinking too much, I got about maybe 30 feet in front of the door where the feed shed was, and I squeezed off around. And next thing you know, I see the bear running out of the shed. Well, I didn't really have time to think of what to do, and I was doing the backstep. And I backstepped right into the boat. I fell in the boat, and the bear knocked me into the boat, actually. So that got a little bit exciting. It didn't turn out very well for the bear, but let's just say I wasn't going to look for the bear.
It ran right over top of you, though, right?
Yeah, it knocked me into the boat, knocked me into the boat just as I squeezed off another round.
Yeah, and that was the end of the bear.
Well, I didn't go look for him that evening, but the next day he wasn't too far away, no. But I had totally missed him on the first shot, so.
Yeah, well, when you're living off-grid, these sort of things happen, and you're that close to nature. Bears are not only bears, you had the little blind dog. Was it blind?
Yeah, the little moo. Yeah, he was
What happened with that? What do you think happened with that dog?
Actually, I think a horned owl ate him. Because he looked like a skunk.
Really?
Yeah, and I know horned owls eat skunks. So all of a sudden one day he just wasn't around. He always stayed in the yard because he was blind. Yeah. You know, he could run around pretty good. But and he used to like to sleep outside when it was hot. So we tied him up outside, and the next day everything was there but no dog. So
yeah,
I don't know what happened. Maybe he just broke free and got lost in the bush, or anyway, something ate him. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's you know, a lot of people listening to the podcast would be like, what? particularly in Southern Ontario where I'm at. But these are the normal things that happen on a daily basis up where you are.
Well, you spend your life in the bush, Jerry, or exposed to it. Things are, you know, it's not always going to be a straight cut, put it that way.
Yep. So Pierre, we had some questions from some people about different sorts of stuff. Living off grid, and for example, so first of all, let's start off. So basically, you're in an unorganized township.
Yeah, our little town here is run by an LSB, like a local services board. So you can pretty much do what you want. I mean, you've seen the house here. We built this, no permits, no nothing. I mean, 30 years ago, but you're kind of still in the same boat. I mean, you want to follow the building code. It's there to safeguard you.
Right.
But, if I want to build a house tomorrow in my yard here, I just build a house. I don't need no permit. I don't need no, you know.
Right.
Which is kind of why we moved up here, is you got freedom, right?
So, yes, just about everything you do down here, you get permits for it and taxed on everything that comes about. So, so you're in an unorganized township, was essentially. So an organized township would be living in a municipality that has formal legislation to give guidelines on how it operates, and it has a warden or a mayor and that sort of thing. But you don't have any of that, just a local services board.
Right. The local services board, their mandate is mostly just to distribute the funding, you know, make sure everything gets paid, the water plan. I mean, we have water, we have sewers, we have one school. I think there's 9 kids in school this year. It's quite a few. Three teachers and nine or 10 kids.
Right. And what grades does the school go to?
Kindergarten to grade 8.
Grade 8. And then what do the kids do for high school?
Well, there's no bus this year. What they've done now, they've always done is the school board pays the kids to board in town. So they'll find a place, like a family member, or just get live with a family or a friend, and then the school board pays those people so much per month to room and board the
when you say in town, you mean in Timmins?
Yeah. Yeah.
So they stay there the entire week and then come home on the weekend?
More or less, yep.
Yeah. So, but it used to be they had a bus, did they not, at one point?
They always had a bus in the old days when there was lots of kids, but now there's no kids. So
right.
I can run a bus for one kid or two kids, you know.
Right. So the local school board or the local services board, the LSB, they collect funds to distribute, as you mentioned. So roughly, you know, what kind of funds would you contribute and what do you get for those funds in an organized township run by the local services board?
Well, we have water and sewer. We have a fire truck. And then what else do we have? Let me see. Now, we have a nurse practitioner that comes in once a week.
Right.
Every Monday, I think. Geez, I don't know, Jerry. We've got
street lights.
Oh, yeah. We have street lights. And, you know, the roads are kept open. We have a local roads board also.
Right.
To keep the town streets open. So besides that, not a whole lot, Jerry. No garbage pickup. The dump's open 4 days a week, a kilometer out of town. You know, you bring your garbage to the dump.
Right.
That kind of stuff. So.
And then, so roughly, what does it cost you for a year to get all the services that you have?
Probably around $1,500.
And that includes all your hydro as well?
No, hydro is a separate thing, Jerry.
Oh, okay, so how much does the hydro run roughly?
Our hydro here.
Any idea?
Yeah, I don't know. It's between $100 and $200. It depends on what you're drawing, right? So,
for how long?
For per month.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. All right.
But off-grid, so, like at the cabin, I mean, I'm pretty I don't have an elaborate system off-grid. So I just run a panel. But mostly I'm just running lights if I need to charge batteries and stuff. But, I mean, there's the extreme version of that as well, right? You can put in enough solar to heat your house if you want. But
so you've got a solar panel that charges just a regular car battery, or what kind of battery?
I got a couple pretty heavy-duty deep cycle, you know.
Yes.
So I can plug in a vacuum if I want, or I can, you know, do stuff like that. And then I run if there's no sun for a long time, I'll run my little Honda 2000 for a couple hours to charge the batteries up, you know, kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
But most of the time I can't use the power. Like if I'm running LED lights and stuff, I can light up the whole cabin and I never run out of power. Like my batteries are always, you know, way up there. So
this is the camp that you have out on the property on one of the lakes that you built.
Yeah. This is on our property that we harvest our wood off of. So,
and how big would the camp be that you're running, and what kind of lights? And
this one is a 16 by 24 and two stories.
Okay.
And it's right on the lake there. The lake's about 100 acres.
Yeah.
And, well, you've been on the property, so it's quite a large piece of land.
Yep.
So I just, you know, it'd be great for people who get to work from home. We're only about 5 clicks from a 4G tower, so. You know.
Okay. And so what do you use for now? You have a way to get service there, do you not?
Well, you can do the
cell service and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's good cell service there. But if you want to get on the internet, you'd have to get like a Starlink or something, you know.
And you use a Starlink?
Yeah. I don't go online there. I just use my phone. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, because we've my sons, Josh and Garrett, Josh, I guess, is responsible. He picked up Starlink for us at my camp. But when we head up to the Chagapican up in the bush, kind of between Chapleau or south of Chapleau, he has the Starlink there. And because they got to have their toys, so they have all the connections there when they turn that Starlink on and run it off a generator.
Right. Now, like, I don't know how much power you would need to run the Starlink, like 4 hours a day or something. I don't know if my battery, my little battery bank would cut it with that, but probably maybe you'd have to put another battery in or two. But I mean, it's simple. It's easy to work out, right? So.
And now it's time for another testimonial for Chaga Health and Wellness. Okay, we've got Rob from Hamilton here who's had some success with the Chaga cream. Rob, can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I've used it on blemishes, cuts, just basically all around healing. Anything kind of blemish, it speeds it up really quick.
Great.
Speeds the healing process up, really well, and leaves no marks and doesn't stain or smells okay.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special offer from Chaga Health and Wellness. If you've listened this far and you're still wondering about this strange mushroom that I keep talking about and whether you would benefit from it or not, I may have something of interest to you. To thank you for listening to the show, I'm going to make trying Chaga that much easier by giving you $1 off all our Chaga products at checkout. All you have to do is head over to our website, ChagaHealthAndWellness.com, place a few items in the cart, and check out with the code CANOPY, C-A-N-O-P-Y. If you're new to Chaga, I'd highly recommend the regular Chaga tea. This comes with 15 tea bags per package, and each bag gives you around 5 or 6 cups of tea. Hey, thanks for listening. Back to the episode.
So in the trap camps, what did you use in the trap camps for lights and things like that and heat and cooking?
Well, we always had a wood stove, Jerry. We cooked on the wood stove. We had a little gas stove as well. We would bring 20-pound propane cylinders in, and we had gas lights, you know, because you need a pretty good light for skinning and stuff, because you always, in the fall, I mean, by the time you got to the camp, most of the time it was dark or getting dark, you know.
Right. Uh-huh.
So you needed pretty good light, so.
So, and just how long would a 20-pound propane light last in the In the big camp? What was that, 12 by 16, 16 by 20?
Yeah, the big camp, 16 by 24. A propane light with a 20-pounder, I don't know. You'd probably do a couple months.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They don't burn a lot of power.
Yeah, so, and it lasts quite, well, obviously, it's enough light.
And you can get fridges, like I got a gas fridge. They, you know, they'll use a little bit more power, a little bit more gas, you know.
Right.
So, but you can buy them used. I mean, I just stopped at a place in Southern Ontario that they take in trailers, like RV trailers, and then they scrap them. So I stopped there to look, and he's got all kinds of 12-volt lights that he takes out of trailers, and he also takes the fridges out and checks them. So you can buy like a pretty big fridge with a freezer on top, used there for about $1,200.
Yeah. And that's a good price for a propane gas fridge?
Yeah. New, they're like $2,000 or $3,000 or $3,000 or $4,000, I'm pretty sure. Like, I've checked them out. Now, a lot of people are going with the 12-volt fridges, but then you're looking at, you know, more money also, so.
Yeah, to run to run either solar panels or the generator to run that system.
Right. So I think with my little gas fridge, I mean, what do I go through? Do I go through 100 pounds a year? Barely, you know.
Right.
And then you have a freezer and you have a fridge, so.
Right.
And you have a stove and you have an oven. Yeah.
Now, your main house in the town that you have, how large is the house there? How many bedrooms you got? Just so people get a sense of the size of it.
Well, this is a log house that we built around an old house. So this, I it must be 3,000-4,000 square feet. It's we added on a 3-story log add-on,
right?
Which ended up being 19 rounds high. It's got to be. It's got 7 rooms, 3 bathrooms, 7 bedrooms,
right?
So now it's kind of odd because everybody's gone and there's only 2 of us home. So.
Right.
I had to brainstorm the other day. I should take the top story off, but I think it'd be too much work.
Right. So when you say 19 rounds, what do you mean? What does that mean?
19 logs stacked one on top of the other.
Okay. So that's, yeah. So 19 logs high sort of thing.
Right. Right. Big, big spruce logs.
Yeah. And how do you heat that house where you are?
Well, we have a boiler that we bought off the Mennonites. It's pretty simple, and I'm heating this house, and I'm heating my brother's next door. I'm heating his house as well. So I'm heating 2 homes with the boiler.
Right.
So we have a little pump that makes the water go around. And I'm using a lot of the old time rads, the old cast iron rads. And then I have a system I got an in-floor heat as well. And then if I need it, I've also got a plenum with a fan in it. So I can, if it gets to 40, I can supercharge the whole thing, get a lot of heat. But we also have a cook stove in the kitchen here.
Right.
That we run, that you help put in.
Yeah. And the cook stove, it's a wood cook stove, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Just a wood. Know. Wood.
Yeah. It's working really well. So, when you get old, Jerry, it seems like you need a little more heat. I don't know.
Well, we don't get old. We just get more experienced, I think it is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. The more experience we get, the more we like that heat to dry out the bones. At least that's the sense that I get, especially when it's damp out.
Yeah. Well, it's nice. You just, when it's so, on those cold days,
So you have a boiler that's outside.
Right.
It's just one of those units that looks like an oversized outhouse sort of thing, right?
Right, right. Which makes it simple because you don't have to bring the wood in the house.
Yeah.
And it's
clean. And then you open that up and you fill it up. How often do you fill up this boiler, and what kind of wood you're putting in, and how long does it last?
Well, I'll put in, we have a lot of slab from the mill. So if I don't need a lot of heat, I'll burn slab, and then I'll throw in a couple pieces of birch overnight because it'll last. So I never have to light it, I feed it three times a day. If I'm home, I'll feed it four times a day and put less wood,
Right.
Right now the draft's closed. I'm just basically have a fire. My water's not real hot, maybe 120, 130. So I don't need hot water. When it's cold, I'll get the water up to 180, 190.
So, and that's what circulates through the heater. So you have the outside boiler unit that you fill up. It heats the water, and then you circulate that through the two houses.
Right. Exactly.
And with those old cast iron units that disperse the heat, which is
those cast irons, people used to just bring them in for scrap steel, but now they've kind of taken on a new life. People are selling them for quite a bit of dough, they've realized that it's a really efficient way to get heat into your home,
Yeah, and so what do you get many power outages where you are in the town? Like, does that happen fairly often? And what do you do in the situation if it's cold nights and a power outage? How do you get that to circulate around through?
Well, back to the power plant, Jerry. I'll fire up the Honda and if it's out for more than 4 or 5 hours, what happens is if you've just stoked the stove and the power goes out, you're not making the water go around, so water will boil, right? So you got to keep that water going.
Yep.
So
so you circulate it with the Delco?
Yeah, the Delco, Jerry.
The Delco. And all that does is circulate it through to make sure it keeps going.
Right, right. I mean, we've had power outages here for a couple of days,
Right.
So.
And so the same with the cook stove in the kitchen heats up quite a bit?
Yeah, I could heat the house with that. So.
Oh, you could?
Yeah. I mean, it might, get a little cold at the other end a bit, but I mean, you could basically keep the house pretty warm with that. So if the water won't freeze in the boiler, it could, as long as, it takes a couple of days to cool that water right off. So it holds 350 gallons, that boiler.
Okay.
And, it's a big piece of steel. So even if the power's out for a day or two, I'll just let it go out and run the cook stove,
Right. Yep.
So if it's not a thing, but usually I'll put the little power plant on it.
Yes.
Keep the water going.
Now, I recall when we were up fishing and my wife Diane and I and yourself, we went out and got some off the lake. We were just talking where you put the camp on.
Right.
And Christine said, make sure you bring back some fish heads. So she was making a fish stock with the fish heads from the pike that we were catching.
Right. Yeah, she's always and got so, something on the go.
Yeah. And so some of the questions we had about how do you keep your chickens and stuff like that when you're getting horned owls taking your dogs and stuff like that? How do you keep them And how many chickens and how anything else that you carry that you grow up that way?
Well, right now we've got about 6 birds, I guess. One's sitting on eggs. So I just candled a bunch of eggs the other day. We'll probably have another 4 or 5 little chicks being born. They're doing pretty good. I keep them inside, and I got a little like a heated water bowl. But I noticed that the raven's been going in there and stealing some of the food.
Okay.
Yeah, we leave the door open to the chicken coop, and little dog was in there, and there was a raven in there. So I'm going to have to talk to that bird and see if I can talk him out of going in there.
And LD, little dog, he put the chase to it, did he?
Yeah, he doesn't like birds. He doesn't like those crows.
No?
Ravens, no. No. Well, he's a little game obsessive, let's just say.
And you said you candled the eggs, just so people understand what that means.
Well, you take a flashlight, like a good, strong flashlight, and you hold the egg, you hold it under the egg, and if you can see through the egg, that means there's no chicken there.
Right.
It'll be clear. Like, you'll be able to see right through the egg. And if it's dark, if the egg is dark, then that means that there's a chicken there. So after about, I don't know, 8-10 days, I'm not an expert, but if you candle the eggs, you can tell which ones have a chicken there, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're feeding them all the scraps and everything, or are they eating the bugs, or you let them out in the yard, or
well, there's
just having them in the coop or what?
All the table scraps, Jerry. Like, every day. We have like a 1-gallon pail, and every 2 days that's full of table scraps, and they just love that. Like anything soft, right, like a tomato or a peach, they just eat that up like crazy. So, and it saves on the food, right?
Well, not only that, but it also saves material from going to the dump as well.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, whereas a lot of it down where we are, you got the green bin that they collect it all once a week. It ends up quite a bit of material.
Right, you're talking about stuff from food, right?
Yeah, food scraps.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically a lot of the food scraps are used for that. So and that was one of the questions that somebody sent in, you know, how do you rear chickens and keep them going and stuff like that. Now, is it something that you can leave for a period of time and then come back, or do you have to have somebody take care of them every single day?
We've been staying in the bush quite a bit, Jerry, like 4 days at a time. And
okay.
I just have my water jug is maybe 3 gallons, and then I've got a pretty big feeder. So I just lock the door and make sure they're clean and they have food, water, and then Philip will check on them. But they'll do 4 or 5 days without any
problems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not great because, they get, I wouldn't say bored, but, they might start eating eggs. All the ones we have now are pretty good. Like, they're not going to eat eggs.
Right.
If you keep a good shell on the egg, you know, feed them a bit of calcium.
Yeah.
If the eggshells get soft. So, and then I put wooden eggs in there. They really don't. You should be able to outsmart a chicken, Jerry.
You put wooden eggs in. What do you put wooden eggs in for?
Well, then if they go to try to eat the egg and it's a wooden egg, after a while they'll give up, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they just stop eating eggs completely.
Yeah. But if you get a bad one, there's some chickens that are just obsessive. So if you can figure out which one it is, well, maybe it's time to eat chicken, you know.
Well, yeah. So how many chickens would you keep going, and how often do you have to cycle them through, sort of thing? How long
will they lay eggs? They lay eggs for maybe 3 years, Jerry. The third year, they start slowing down a bit.
Right.
So a couple of years. But if you've got a family, like two or three kids, I would say 5-6 birds would be lots. Like, you'll be giving eggs away or selling them, you know.
Right.
Because those chickens will lay an egg a day. So, you're getting 5-6 eggs a day. I mean, it's pretty hard to eat 5-6 eggs a day.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. So what do you do with all your extra eggs then?
Well, we were selling them, but right now our chickens are getting kind of old. So we're down to 2 or 3 eggs a day. So we usually manage to use most of those up. So,
right.
Yeah.
And do you rear anything else, like turkeys or anything else, or have you?
We have had meat birds. We buy the white rocks. So but Christine doesn't like, not too keen on killing chickens anymore. So it's a bit of a job. Like, you know, you got 40, 40 birds and you got to do them all at the same time. And it,
right.
It's a lot of work. So,
yeah. And then you just keep them in the freezer till they're ready to be consumed.
Right. Right. You know, then you got your chicken for the whole year kind of thing. Right.
Right. Right.
Right.
Now down our way, down Southern Ontario, right now the smelt run is on.
Oh, go get smelts, Jerry.
Oh, do you get many smelts? Do you get any smelts up that way?
No, I'd have to go on a road trip to get smelts. But
where do you go up there to get smelts?
You'd have to go to Wawa, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's quite a drive, so I won't bother. But we have gone down to Lake Ontario, where you are, and got them.
Those runs aren't like they used to be anymore at all. When you go down, we virtually see nothing like they used to be. I mean, we used to, and guys would show up and basically almost fill the back of a half ton full of pails full of smelt.
Oh, it was great.
Nothing like that at all anymore now. If you got five or six in a night, you had a good night now. It just, the population is completely decimated this way.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's the smelt population. Well, what happened was, most people don't know, and I saw one of the other in the podcast network, the Outdoor Radio Journal podcast network, they were talking about smelts or bait fish. What happened was there was an agreement with the other U.S. jurisdictions that are on the Great Lakes on the number of salmonoids, which would be your trout and your salmon that were put into the water right at the time when the derbies were huge in Ontario and the other states as well.
Right.
So we had all these derbies that were taking hundreds of thousands of predator fish out of the lakes. But when the derbies ended, a lot of the jurisdictions were still continuing to put the same amount of salmonoids in the lake with the agreement.
Oh.
And it completely depleted the bait stock. So virtually have not many smelts now down our way anymore.
Huh? Crazy, Jerry.
Yep. What about fiddlehead? Fiddlehead. You get fiddleheads up your way?
Yeah, I don't know, Jerry. I don't pick those.
Yeah, they're out now along with a bunch of other things. So
I have seen them though, but I just don't bother to pick them.
Right, and there was another one that you picked the harvested the 1 year when Diane and I came up, and the hazelnuts.
Yeah, they're great. They're small though, but the taste is crazy.
Oh. If people, the wild hazelnuts, and it's just, is it a bush or a tree?
It's like a tree, Jerry. Like about a 10, 12. Oh. It looks like a tag alder tree.
Yep.
I mean, it looks like that from far, but it's not the same. But and then they're just covered in hazelnuts. So.
Yeah, and you were roasting them, right?
Or just eating them raw. But what you have to do is pick them, and they got that little furry shell on them.
Yep.
So I put them in a feed bag, like a burlap bag, and I put them in the dark for like a month. And then you can knock that little furry part off.
Okay.
And then you're just stuck with the shell. Then you got to break the shell to get at the fruit, right?
Yeah.
But the fruit's not very big. It's maybe the size of a pea.
That's all on the wild ones, yes.
Yeah, but the taste is crazy.
Yeah, for those people that haven't tried them, it's almost like if you've ever eaten Nutella. I was up there and I just said, look, take these away from me, Pierre, because I'm going to eat too many of these things.
Right, right. No, they're really good.
So Diane and I tried the next year to go up to the camp we go to south of Chapleau there. And we went up in August and found all the hazelnut trees and bushes that were up there. And the leaf kind of looks like a birch leaf almost.
Right.
And so we found them all, and we had it all lined up where we probably had like a bushel basket or more of hazelnuts that we figured we'd be able to harvest because we were going to try it was a Chaga wild hazel,
right.
Hazelnut tea. And we got up there a month later to harvest them, and we're looking, and all the bushes are completely empty. There was nothing anywhere. And so we're looking at all these. So we went to my cousins, and I said, have you just been picking hazelnuts? They said, hazelnuts? What do you mean hazelnuts? I said, well, you got hazelnuts right here at the camp. We do? I said, yeah, right here and there. And I showed them all the hazelnut bushes. Oh, I didn't know that. And so, no, we haven't been picking them. So all of a sudden, Diane and I are out. And we come around. We're walking down one of the trails. And we come around the corner. And there, standing on its hind end, is a black bear grabbing the hazelnut bush and eating all the hazelnuts.
Wow.
Now we know where all the hazelnuts were gone. Was a black bears were eating them up there.
Wow. And squirrels, yeah. And squirrels, I guess.
Oh, yes, I would imagine so. Right. But, yeah, it was just surprising to see the black bear standing on its hind haunches, grabbing the bush and then pulling it in, puts his arms around it and pulls it in and eats all the hazelnuts.
Right.
Yeah.
Crazy, Jerry. Yeah, we got lots of people moving up. Well, I wouldn't say lots of people moving up from southern Ontario, but there's a lot of mining work now where guys are doing 7 days on, 7 days off. So there's, you know, it doesn't matter where you live, if you know.
Yes.
So a good house in town here, now they're up. The price of houses has gone a little crazy in town. You're going to pay $100,000, you know, for a decent house. Used to be 40 or 50.
It used to be 40 or 50. Now it's 100.
Yeah, it's gone nuts, Jerry.
Well, it's a boom. Comparatively speaking, you know, so for April in 2024, $100,000 for a house is a good house, as you just said,
right,
is not too bad, especially with all the services and the bells and whistles that you can get up there, like you said.
It's the same price as where you are, Jerry. You got to take a zero off.
Exactly. So what kind of mining is taking place up there, Pierre?
Well, there's a new mine just opened up in Gogama. So they're not letting people travel there, I hear. It's seven on, seven off. And no, they feed you like you're staying, you know. And then there's a new mine going up in Dubreuilville, which is about a 3.5 hour drive. So there's a few guys from town working there now. They're seven and seven.
What kind of mines are they?
Gold.
What are they mining?
Mostly gold, Jerry. And then Detour, north of Cochrane. I got a couple of buddies working there.
Right.
You have a choice there. If you can find a buddy, they'll let you work seven and seven or 14 days on, 14 days off.
Okay.
Some guys would rather have that, right? But if you take a cycle off a year, I think, which you're allowed to do. I mean, I got a buddy there that did, he worked 23 weeks last year.
Okay.
And made, you know, a lot of money, you know.
So, okay.
Yeah.
So for employment-wise, so mining and the forestry sectors, because you run a mill yourself, yeah. Are the big employers in the north still?
The forestry sector is a little beat up, let's say, but there's CN Rail here in town. A lot of guys work the rail. They're always looking for guys. And then there's the mining jobs, you know.
Right.
So...
Well, we mentioned when you talked about the bear incident, you had horses back then, right?
Right.
Or your brother did, and he was horse logging, or you were horse logging.
Right. Well, we both did the horse logging, yeah.
So how does horse logging differ from what people would normally do now? I don't think there's a lot of horse loggers out there anymore.
There's no more little independent loggers left, Jerry. I think I'm the last one. I'm on the endangered species list.
Yeah.
If I had a feather, if I could grow a feather or a little bit of fur, somebody would try to save me, I think. But anyway. But there's no more independent guys. Like the corporations have pretty much tied up the land base and they manage the forest, right? So
yeah.
Like the ecoms of the world, you know. So
not a lot of horse logging at all, but you used to do horse logging or
Well, we used to be able to get a license, like in the old days it was called a DCL, like a district cutting permit. But now they've just made it too onerous. And like if we didn't have our own private land, I don't think I would be logging anything, you know, or milling anything, you know. It's just too much of a – and, you know, it's kind of sad because, I mean, you can do some nice work. Like we run a little piece of equipment. We leave the small trees standing, take the big trees, you know. We've seeded our land. We've planted trees. You know, we've actually seeded crown land. We've actually not seeded, but planted crown land at our own cost years ago.
Right.
But, you know, nobody's got the initiative to put the system in place. Kind of, it's just too easy to deal with a corporate world. You know, they just fill out all the papers. They have their people and.
The
license. Well, you've been exposed to that, Jerry, having done your little stint at Queen's Park, you know.
Yes.
So.
Yes, that you helped out with.
Yeah, it's not people friendly in the forestry, like, you know.
Well, yeah.
Want us in the bush, so.
Yeah. So, and you spend a lot of time. So, a lot of income is still with the working for the main. Well, not so much as forestry, as you said, but a lot of the mining is catching on, and gold mining particularly.
Well, a lot of the right now the forestry sector around here is pretty much shut down for a couple months. I mean, they're over inventory of wood. The markets are down a bit, so. You know, and then the guys don't stay home. I mean, a lot of them guys are really good on pieces of equipment. So whether you're running a shovel in the bush or running a shovel at the mine, it's basically the same thing. So
okay.
So why would you stay home? You just put your name in at a mine and, you know, somebody will call you, especially if you're 40 years old and you got 20 years experience on a shovel. You aren't going to stay home for very long.
Right.
You know.
And so some of the things then, so for example, you supply some groups with some fiber as well, some wood.
Yeah, last year we did two dovetail homes.
Right.
And what else did we do? A lot of cedar. We deal with the Mennonites a lot with cedar. Okay. So, we sell them round logs, not a whole lot. And they do fence posts as well. They have a peeler, so they do a lot of fence posts for their own folks, you know. And they
right. Yep.
And they sell a lot of fence posts.
Right.
So we have our own little world around here with that. But the Mennonites are great to deal with. You know, it's a handshake. And next thing you know, and, you know, you're not chasing paperwork, you know.
Right.
But some of the mills we deal with, the one, I'm not going to mention it by name, but it's a farmer that's running the show out there. And he'll buy wood off us if we have extra softwood, you know, a load or two. You know, which
right.
I kind of told him that, you know, there used to be our contracts were like pages and pages thick and addendums. And I'm like, I want it on one page. I said, I want the price, how much we can send, the rates on one page. So he phoned me back a couple of days after. He says, can I use both sides of the page? He says.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, you know, but a lot of them are willing to work with you. It's just, you know, between the M&R and the corporate world, it's just too hard for us little guys to live in that world. Nobody right. wants a line skidder on their, you know, and a guy with a power saw cutting on their SFL, you know, their light.
SFL license stands for?
Well, sustainable.
Sustainable forest license, yeah.
Yeah, so nobody, right. They just don't want us around, right? And all they have to say is no, and we just leave. So
right,
easy peasy, right?
So, and you mentioned the Mennonites. Now, Mennonites did some work for Philip that was kind of interesting not too long ago the grand scheme of things. What kind of stuff did they do there that was rather unique?
Well, he hired them to build a building because he's moving his store to the corner in town here. And so we did the footing and all that kind of stuff, poured all that. They showed up here Monday. He had to go and pick them up because they don't drive, of course. And they showed up with a crew, maybe six, seven guys, wives. Right. Philip had to put them up. They came with all their own food. And in 7 days, and let's remember they don't work Sundays. In 7 days, they put up that building, Jerry. It was 80 by 120.
And 80 feet by 120 feet, seven right, days.
Framed, tinned, insulated. The big doors were in, the windows were in, and the floor was poured. Like really? 7 days. People were just amazed. Like you would leave for work and come back and all the walls are framed. You're like, well, what the heck just happened? You know?
Yeah.
But nobody's tripping over anybody. Everybody's smiling. They're all, you know.
And they all know their job, that this is exactly what I do, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And in order for me to move in there, he's finished. As soon as I see that, I move right. Yeah, so it's a well-organized machine.
Oh, yeah.
That put up this huge building in 7 days.
It was funny, Jerry, because, of course, they did, like, they have landlines at home, right? Like phones.
Right.
But they're not allowed to have a cell phone. So anyway, the builder guy, he's like, well, I got to be able to call home or, you know, see how the cows are doing. I don't know. So they had a meeting and they said Philip could give them a cell phone, but it had to stay connected to the wall. So he wasn't allowed to carry it around. He had to find a spot for it and leave it hooked up to the wall. Then he could use his the cell phone while he was there only.
Okay.
So it was kind of neat, you know.
No, it's different, you know, different lifestyles in different areas. So certainly a lot of different things take place. And everybody assumes that the entire world operates in the same fashion that's found basically from my perspective in Southern Ontario. And it's substantially different when you get to other parts of the province or the country as well.
Yeah, they have, you know, like their children only go to grade 8.
Right.
We've had them up in the bush because they love coming up in the bush, right? So we had them up there, had the big fire going, the lunch. They bring all their homemade food. And I was talking to the young lad there. I don't know how old he was, maybe 12. You know, you give them an axe. Next thing you know, there's a fire going. They got everything's, you know. And yep. He says they go to grade 8, this group, and I don't know if they're all the same. They spend 2 years with the parents on the farm. Yes. And then they spend 2 years with somebody in their group. Like, you know, if you want to learn carpentry skills, you'll go work with the carpenter guy. Like there's a, you know, different skills in their village, right?
Yeah.
So the kid spends 2 years with that group, and then I guess he's on his own. I mean, he works and they just fit him in, you know.
Okay.
So it's a whole different way.
It's very interesting. Yeah.
It's different. No cell phones, no radio, no TV.
Right.
You know, I mean, I phone there because the fella I deal with, he's done his chores at 7:30 in the morning. So that's when I call him.
Right.
And the schoolhouse was a little far away. So the young lad, I think he was 10 or 11. He had to go harness the horse to bring him and his sister to school. You know.
Okay.
I don't know if you know any kids that have to harness the horse in the morning to go to school. You know.
No, as a matter of fact, I don't.
Right.
But certainly a different kind of lifestyle. So what other kind of stuff off-grid living can you think of that people might be interested in or a little bit different than what the normal expectation would be, say, in Southern Ontario?
Yeah, I don't know, Jerry. Like you can buy land and build a house and do whatever you want. I mean, it's just not in people's mindset anymore, I think. I don't know. Like it's not an easy life, you know.
No.
I mean,
but when you get up in the morning, you got purpose. Whether it's to harness the horse to get to school, to get to school, it's not just, okay, stand at the street corner and wait,
right.
And somebody's going to take care of you. You know, you have purpose when you get up in the morning, and whether it's running the mill or running the stuff in the bush, you want to make sure that everything's safe. I mean, look at the amount of time you spent in the bush when you were trapping that one time, and how, if anything ever happened to you, how would anybody know?
Yeah, no. Nobody would know. I mean, it would be a month before anybody even come to look.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
That's a choice you make. And you know, it's a different life. I mean, I'm not pensioned out. I still go to work at my age. I like working 6-7 hours a day, you know. And yeah. One of my good friends, Mark, who still comes up and sees me all the time, we were in grade 12, and I told him what I was doing. I was going up north trapping, and he was supposed to come up with me.
Right.
And 2 days before we were on the go, like we were finished our grade 12 and we're like, let's get out of here. GM called him in Oshawa.
Right.
And his mom said, Mark, you're not going trapping. Your dad works there. Your brother works there. You're going to work there. You know, so Mark spent, I don't know, 32 years at the motors, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not a negative thing. I mean, the guy has had a good life. He's got a pension, the buyout, the whole thing, you know, but he was up here a couple months ago and he says, I wonder what would have happened if I hadn't have gone and done that. I said, you'd still be working, Mark. You'd still have a job.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have a house paid for and a pension and the whole thing, you know. And then if you
well,
have
you
a
need
partner, your partner's got to be into what you're doing as well, you know.
That's right.
So.
Yeah. It's important to have a reason to get up in the morning.
And, you know, like you just said, get up and go do this and go do that. Well, you can wake up in the morning in your house that you just built and work offline. I mean, there's lots of people now, even in our little town, that a lady just applied for a job 4 days a week from home. And then 1 day a week, she got to drive into town.
Right. So, town being Timmins.
Yeah. So.
Right.
So she's going to drive to town 45 times next year. And then that day, she'll probably buy her food that she needs for the week or do whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So there are different ways of looking at stuff, but you know, but your whole income is not geared towards paying for a house that's $700,000 or $800,000. You know, like.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Anyway, different lifestyle, Jerry.
Well, certainly a lot of people need to take the time to appreciate that and understand that it exists out there.
That's true.
Because everybody believes that what I see is part of the problems in the whole world is everybody base the standards of the world based on what they have immediately in front of them. And it's not like that. Not here, not compared to Northern Ontario or even farther north, the far north or in other countries as well.
Well, let's look at you, Jerry. Like another 10 or 15 or 20 years, when we're all getting a little older, and what are you going to do with your house? You're either going to leave it to one of your kids, or sell it because you can't keep it going anymore because you don't have that income. Your pension's not probably going to cover. You know, like your taxes are $500-$600 a month. Well, you can have a lot of fun with $500 or $600. You know.
Yes.
So
yeah, that's for sure.
Just a different way to look at stuff. I mean, we're all going to end up in the same place anyway.
So, Pierre, if people want more information, how do they get in touch with you, or how do they find out about what you're dealing with, or have any questions, or what way can they get in touch with you?
Well, I don't want my phone to ring all day, Jerry.
Well, you got the email.
Yeah.
You still got email, right?
Email, Jerry. Email. Yeah, yeah. Okay. You can do a link to my iPad. I'll send people some pictures and stuff, and you know, I don't mind a phone call once in a while, but I mean, and a lot of times I'm right on the edge of sell, as you know,
Yes, I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
One bar.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Pierre, for taking the time to give us some insight on what it's like in an unorganized community and off-grid applications and things like that, because people were asking, and I said, I know the guy,
right,
and this is the guy.
Right. Well,
Pierre.
Okay, Jerry.
It's always a pleasure, and it's always nice to be able to hear that. Well, it was such a time; it was worth a story.
That's right. Okay, Jerry. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Pierre. Talk to you.
Over and out.
Just another way people can enjoy life under the canopy.
Hi, everybody. I'm Angelo Viola.
And I'm Pete Bowman.
Now, you might know us as the hosts of Canada's favorite fishing show, but now we're hosting a podcast.
That's right. Every Thursday, Ange and I will be right here in your ears, bringing you a brand new episode of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Now, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours every week?
Well, you know there's going to be a lot of fishing.
I knew exactly where those fish were going to be and how to catch them, and they were easy to catch.
Yeah, but it's not just a fishing show. We're going to be talking to people from all facets of the outdoors, from athletes.
All the other guys would go golfing. Me and Garth and Turk and all the Russians would go fishing.
To scientists.
But now that we're reforesting and letting things free, it's the perfect transmission environment for Lyme disease.
To chefs.
If any game isn't cooked properly,
marinated,
you will taste it.
And whoever else will pick up the phone.
Wherever you are, Outdoor Journal Radio seeks to answer the questions and tell the stories of all those who enjoy being outside.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
How did a small-town sheet metal mechanic come to build one of Canada's most iconic fishing lodges? I'm your host, Steve Nidzwicki, and you'll find out about that and a whole lot more on the Outdoor Journal Radio Network's newest podcast, Diaries of a Lodge Owner. But this podcast will be more than that. Every week on Diaries of a Lodge Owner, I'm going to introduce you to a ton of great people, share their stories of our trials, tribulations, and inspirations. Learn and have plenty of laughs along the way.
Meanwhile, we're sitting there bobbing along trying to figure out how to catch a bass. And we both decided one day we were going to be on television doing a fishing show.
My hands get sore a little bit when I'm reeling in all those bass in the summertime, but that's might be for more fishing than it was punching.
You so confidently you said, "Hey, Pat,
Have you ever eaten a drum?
Find Diaries of a Lodge Owner now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.